You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 35, Spock's Periwinkle Tights. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the upcoming Broadway run of Shatner's World, We Just Live in It, a possible Star Trek TV series pitch from Brian Fuller and Bryan Singer, the TNG Remastered Season 1 trailer, and more news surrounding the TNGR project, and some movie news and rumors. We also dip into our mailbag for some listener thoughts on our recent discussions of blood fever and regeneration. Oh, and did I mention our mind scanner? In the feature, we're joined by David Taylor as we discuss the original series episode, Errand of Mercy. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I'm doing great, Chris. You know, actually, the sun is out for the first time I can think of in a while. You know, I find the key to Seattle weather is to keep your expectations really low, expect it to always be rainy and dreary, and then when it finally is sunny, which is actually sunny more often than you think, but when it actually is sunny, it's this huge relief. Wow, I can't believe it's beautiful out, and you just want to go out and enjoy it so much.
I see. So that's like on a Starfleet ship where you just... You always expect that there's going to be a potential warp core breach. And then on a mission, when the warp core works perfectly the whole time, you feel wonderful about it.
Exactly.
Because your expectations were just so low, right?
The captain didn't blow up the ship this time. Awesome.
That's right. You know, I think you've been having your own little version of the chase there this past week, haven't you? As you've been going around looking for the... Well, instead of looking for DNA fragments, you've been looking for the TNG, the next level Blu-ray sampler.
I have. You know, I looked at Walmart. I looked at Target. I looked at Fred Meyer, which, as I explained to you on the other side of the room, is not this guy I know, but it's an actual chain of stores that they have on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah. I thought he was just some guy down the street from you.
Hey, Fred.
Hey, Fred. You got an extra one of them Blu-rays?
But no, Mr. Meyer did not have any of the TNG Next Level Blu-rays. And I'm starting to think this is just a problem that CBS is having, selling what's essentially a promo disc to retailers. And maybe they think, I mean, you look at Amazon, there's so many like one-star reviews where people are complaining it's way too much money for just three episodes. And while, you know, they would have stocked a VHS tape of the original series that had two episodes, you know, back in the day, maybe retailers just don't have the faith that this sort of disc will actually sell.
It could be. Yeah, I have no idea. I order everything from Amazon myself, and I pre-ordered it back then. But I did notice that on the American Amazon site, they have stock and it's available. And so, you know, maybe, yeah, retailers are just getting a fairly small number of copies or just not carrying it.
Yeah. And I'm sure if I went to one of the real big box stores, like Best Buy or... I was going to say Circuit City, but I guess Circuit City isn't even around anymore. But one of those stores, I'm sure, would have it. But my plan at this point is just to order it from Amazon, and hopefully it'll be here by next week's show. We can actually talk about the 7.1 surround sound fluid action.
Yeah, and by then I will have mine,
right.
I believe, because it's coming out here on February 10th. So I'm still very jealous of everyone over there who is watching this.
I know.
All I can do is look at the screen stills on TrekCore and watch the trailers pretty much. So
you'd think they could just go in Netflix and just replace the episodes with the new versions. I've been watching Battlestar Galactica on Netflix, and it's amazing the quality, because I've never seen it in HD before. And
yeah. It's... On Netflix, because again, we don't have Netflix here, for something like the original series, do they have the original cuts and then they have the remastered, or is it all just remastered now?
It's all just the remastered, yeah.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah, they never even put the originals on there, which I think you can... You used to be able to get the originals somehow online. I forget how. Maybe Xbox used to
iTunes...
sell both of them. Does iTunes still sell both of them?
I'm not positive, but I think iTunes still, at least at some point, they did have both. I'm not sure if it's only remastered now or not, but I think they still have both. Well, I guess when the Next Generation seasons start coming out, they will probably start replacing them on Netflix, I think.
You'd think
that's
so.
My guess.
I imagine there will be a window where they're going to try to sell the sets and sell the syndication rights. I expect so, but I guess we'll just have to see.
Yeah. Well, Greg, there was one story I wanted to tell you. You know, last show we were talking about Siri and right. how Siri doesn't like my accent. And the funniest thing that happened this week, and you're actually involved in this.
Okay.
I don't know if you know. But so, you know, I'll tell Siri Siri things like, and when I say Siri, I'm actually talking about the voice dictation on the iPhone 4S, right. not just Siri, but so like if I'm doing iMessage and I'm out walking, instead of typing it, I'm just, you know, saying something and sending it to right. you that way as it transcribes it. And, you know, I'll say something like, you'll ask me about an episode and I'll say something like, oh, I'll have to watch that episode after I get home. And I'll look at the screen and it'll say something like, I'll have to watch that episode after I wash the goat or something like that, you know, that has not what I said. And you would think that a sentence like, I'll have to watch that episode after I get home would be pretty easy, right?
Right.
But no, no. However, as I'm listening to Dork Trek the other day when I was walking down to the grocery store, I sent you a message that Siri had absolutely no problem with and transcribed perfectly the first time. And that message was, apparently, Klingons have 16 foreskins. And
no problem at
and
all.
And it was flawless. I mean, so that's no problem. Even Klingons was capitalized.
Well, Siri is your personal assistant. So, you know, at this point, she knows, oh, here's another tweet about Klingons.
Yeah, I guess. I was shaking my head. I'm like, okay, you got that one right.
What was great is I got that message, and I'd already listened to the Dork Trek episode about the bonding, you know, a week or two before you did, and I didn't remember. So I was like,
yeah, you forgot.
Chris, what are you talking about? Is this like some detail you can see on the new Blu-ray?
Oh, that's right. You asked me. Yeah, you know, the image quality is so good in that episode. And there's that scene that was cut out of the original where Worf's taking a bath.
Wow, let's get this show back on track now.
Before he dresses up in his scant.
Oh, man. That was...
All right, yeah.
But yeah,
well,
Siri,
yeah, let's get back on track here.
Siri does some incredible transcription.
One other thing,
leave it there.
Oh, yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention before we jump into the news here is just to send out a thanks to our listener, Colin, in the UK, who went through the UK store of iTunes and left us some 5-star reviews for The Ready Room and Captain's Log and Matterstream. And we really appreciate that, Colin. It's great to get some feedback in the other stores around the world, too, and not just in the US store. So thanks a lot for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Glad that you're enjoying the shows. All right, Greg. Well, we've been talking about TNG Remastered already a bit here, and that's actually our first news story this week because we do have some new developments now that the sampler has hit the shelves.
Yes, we do. And I believe the main announcement is they have announced an actual plan for the seasons to be released. They're going to be doing two seasons a year. Although I believe it'll be this year just one season, right? Or are they actually getting a second one out this year?
The way I read it would be one for this year, and then after that, they'll probably do two per year.
Right, so we'll get the last season in 2015, if my math is correct.
Right, and I don't think CBS put out any press release or anything that like specifically said 2015, but if you just do the math, if they're saying at a rate of approximately two per year, that's where you would end
exactly, up. Exactly. And just in time for the, you know, huge slam bam 50-year celebration in 2016, which I'm sure they're planning all sorts of things for.
That's right. Wow. That is, you know, I mean, obviously I knew that, but until you said it there, 50 years.
Yeah,
wow.
It's crazy. It's coming up on, I mean, sure, it's still only 2012 right now, but it's coming up. We might actually have a third Abramsverse film by then, by 2016.
Probably, or at least we'll have, you know, like a sketch script on a napkin or something.
Something like that. A promo disc, perhaps. Perhaps we'll have a Blu-ray promo disc of the new film.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a pity that neither of us have that disc and actually can talk about the image quality, because so many people on Twitter right now are talking about how amazing it looks and how they're enjoying it and how, you know, you can see so much more detail in the flute and the batleth and the scants. And I
wonder,
I can't see any of it right now.
Yeah. You know, another bit to this news story here is that CBS has said that other Star Trek series are now under consideration for remastering, which of course we have, you know, talked about that we fully expected that anyway. But I wonder, when they get to Blood Oath on DS9, with that image quality, will you be able to tell that batleth that Dax orders is different from all the other batleths that we've seen in Star Trek?
How is this batleth different from all the other batleths? That's a very obscure joke. But yeah, I'm hoping they'll go through and digitally replace the batleth with a brand new, you know, shiny, advanced batleth. That's exactly what Jadzia ordered, rather than just, shoot, we forgot to get a batleth. Where's that extra one from next gen?
Yeah, no, toss that over here. Because she was just so specific. So maybe we'll actually see that they did create a prop for her that lived up to what she was asking for.
Right. Yeah, I hope they do. And I guess at this rate, maybe we'll have DS9 in 2006, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Voyager can come out. So I guess by next decade, we'll be able to watch all of our Star Trek series in pristine high definition.
Yeah, as we lay in our beds in the nursing home.
Exactly. I remember when this was only in standard definition. Remember when Enterprise was only high definition and it wasn't super high definition?
That's right. Oh, seriously, I think that they're going to have to do them side by side, though. I don't think that they can do Next Generation out to 2015 and then do DS9 and take 5 years to do that and then do Voyager.
Yeah.
They're going to have to. But I think they'll be able to. I think we talked about this last week, too, that as they get the techniques
exactly
up, and the fact that, you know, as these series go on and you get closer and closer to our own time when they were produced, the quality of what they produced the first time will be better.
Right.
And they'll have a little bit less work to do.
I would expect by 2014 for them to start coming out with the DS9 and Voyager Blu-rays as well at that point. Just have them all overlapping, and I would expect by 2016 we'll have at least some of all of the series in Blu-ray and high definition and ready for airing for that spectacular 50-year celebration that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. Well, CBS put out a trailer now for season one. Mm-hmm. It shows a little bit of the special features, I guess, that we'll see on there. Mm-hmm. They, you know, talked to Mike Okuda, they talked to Craig Weiss and even Rod Roddenberry. And Rod said that he's sure if his father were alive today to see the quality of what's being produced with the Next Generation remastered, that he would be relieved and happy that his original vision and the vision of the creative team, you know, is finally being realized and the fans can see what it was supposed to look like in the first place.
Yeah. And he'd be very, very angry about Deep Space Nine.
Maybe.
Well, let's see. I was going to ask, have we heard anything about the commentary tracks? Are they planning on recording some new commentaries? That's one thing I love from this sort of release.
Yeah. I haven't heard anything myself. I certainly hope that they do, because like you, that's what I really look forward to. It's one reason why I still buy DVDs and Blu-rays instead of buying TV shows or movies from iTunes or, you know, or Amazon or anywhere, because I care, especially shows that I've already seen the episodes 20 times, like Star Trek. You know, what I really care about is the commentary. And so I hope that they will. I haven't heard anything, but I do think that they have to put some kind of value add in this on top of just the fact that the picture quality is better. And I think, and especially with this being the 25th anniversary year for the Next Generation, mm-hmm. I think they'll probably round up the actors and spend some money to get some more commentary from them and the writing staff and the creative team as well.
I
certainly hope so.
Just get Frakes and Surtees in a booth for 3 hours. I mean, screen some episodes and just record them. I mean, you don't even have to use it. Just, you know, release it as its own disc. There's going to be some sort of gold in there.
Well, you know, what I think they should do is instead of spending all that money on the actors, is they should just hire Dork Trek to come in and do commentaries for every episode.
Perfect. That would be great. Actually, I actually would not mind Dork Trek switching to a commentary format, because while I do enjoy listening to them after the fact, I'd love to have the experience of listening to them synced up with the show and have them reacting directly with it.
Reacting to what's on the screen.
You get to an episode like, was it, you want to call it Errand of Mercy, but it's not that one. It's not Samaritan Snare. It is Booby Trap. Where they spend the first, what was it, half of the episode talking
about
just
a half an hour
about Geordi's first date.
Yeah, I know.
It was, you know, a minute and a half of the episode, but it was most of the episode of Dork Trek. So I love that. But still, I'd love to see some commentaries from them and see
I
them reacting.
I think that's the one, or maybe it was Who Watches the Watchers, one where I'm listening. I think I've been listening for about an hour. And then I think it's Dennis comes in with, okay, well, so now we're on the ship, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's act two.
Right, exactly.
So we're like, how far into this episode are we? So that would be fun.
Your trick's
all right. Well, what else do we have here as we talk about Star Trek on TV, Greg? There's this story has resurfaced again about Brian Fuller and Brian Singer talking about teaming up for a Star Trek TV show pitch. And we talked about this a long time ago in the Ready Room. But this has resurfaced again as if maybe they've said something again about considering it.
Yeah, it seems like. I mean, Singer at least had a pitch developed. Fuller was starting to figure out something. And I guess the idea is, why don't they pool their resources and pitch something to CBS that's really going to actually happen? And CBS is expressing some interest as well, which is something we haven't heard from them in a while. I'm not really sure what this would mean. I mean, Singer's plan was the one that was like in the year 3000, which I think I was really against. I hated pretty much all of the pitch. And he's working I've heard, on ruining Battlestar Galactica in its own a new reboot that's not based on the old show or the new show.
Right. As we were talking about in the other side of the room.
Yes.
Right. Well, I it sounds like from the news story I read that in addition to that, they're also working on running the Munsters.
Yes.
In a reboot of the classic TV show, which apparently is titled Mockingbird Lane.
Yeah, and it's going to be an hour long, more of a drama, sort of like True Blood meets Twilight. I don't know about Mockingbird Lane, but it
so they're all going to be vampires. All the monsters are going to be vampires this time.
I think it's just going to be more of a dark take on it. Not so much a sitcom. Sort of with the reboot of Bewitched, which did that ever happen? Did that actually go to pilot even?
I don't.
They were going to make Bewitched into an hour long sort of drama comedy, and I don't think that ever happened. We'll see if Mockingbird Lane actually happens as well.
Oh gosh. It'll be canceled in the first six episodes, probably.
Right.
But that's how all TV shows
most likely
are these days, right?
Maybe almost. If we can talk about it enough on the show, it'll get canceled before it goes to pilot.
Right.
But
yes, Mockingbird Lane.
Mockingbird Lane, coming soon
Greg
to NBC.
Said Mockingbird Lane.
No, but to be serious, Singer and Fuller teaming up is not a bad idea. I do like a lot of what Singer's done on TV. I like a lot of what Fuller has done on TV. So I like the idea of them going for it more than if... not to brag on Rick Berman, but just, you know, they just brought Rick Berman again and said, you know, try to make a new show. I like the idea of getting some new blood in there. There's this huge debate going on Twitter, and I'm sure in real life this week, about the Before Watchmen comics. Have you heard much about this, Chris?
No, I haven't.
Are you familiar with the 1986 seminal graphic novel Watchmen?
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not a reader of it, but yeah, I know.
Okay. Well, basically the creator of it, Alan Moore, he's this crotchety old guy who doesn't want anyone to do anything with his stuff. He basically sold out to DC, got a lot of money, and now sits in his corner in England and yells at everyone. And nothing against Alan Moore. He's a genius, but he's a crotchety genius. And essentially the story is DC is making prequel comics, and they've hired people, including Babylon 5's J. Michael Straczynski to write new Watchmen comics. And everyone's up in arms because, you know, Moore doesn't want it done. And how can you have new people doing this thing that was Moore's baby? You know, the only person who can make new Watchmen is Alan Moore. And I really disagree with that. I think there's a certain point where you need new blood to be brought in. And you look at something like Star Trek, where it did take people not Roddenberry to really turn the show around. And sure, not everyone who worked on Star Trek was a genius, and not every bit of Star Trek that was after Roddenberry was great. But I just think every 10 years or so, a franchise needs an injection of new blood, or it just stagnates. You know, look at Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. Ugh. Well, that goes for everything, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm a big college football fan, and Urban Meyer, who is, you know, known as one of the great coaches in college football right now, who has, you know, after taking a year off, he's taking the job at Ohio State, and he made a comment recently that these days, you know, no one should be coaching the same program for more than 10 years.
Mm, there you go.
You look, you know, Joe Paterno just passed away, who. You know, everyone, I think even non-college football fans know who Joe Paterno is, as the coach of Penn State for the past 45 years, maybe, and he was on the staff for about 60 years. And, you know, you'll never see that kind of thing again.
Right.
Because like you say, and like Urban Meyer was saying, you know, 10 years, things do stagnate and you do need that new blood. So in that sense, I would agree that if and when, I say if, I mean, I'm sure at some point there will be a new Star Trek television series. So when there is a new series, I expect there to be new blood. They're not going to go back and bring in Rick Berman and Brandon Braga and all these guys who were working on it before.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting to keep an eye on as it develops, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see where it goes. And in the meantime, why don't we hop over to, this is actually, Greg, something that we've wanted to do on the show for a long time, which is a little mailbag segment here.
Right.
And we actually have a mailbag this week. And this comes to us from listener Rebecca Skipper in Lake Glen, Florida. And she actually sent us, since the time we recorded the Ready Room last week, she has sent us two letters, one about our Blood Fever show and one about our Regeneration show last week. So let me just read what she said here, and then let me get your thoughts on it. Now, after we talked about Blood Fever and how they have to resolve the Blood Fever, and Tuvok's like, yeah, why don't you guys roll around in the dirt a little bit there, and it's broke. Yeah, they're going to be okay now. So she said, I have an alternative ending for Voyager's Blood Fever episode that may satisfy some viewers. If you have read William Shatner's The Return, then you know that the Romulans brought Kirk back using Borg technology.
Mm-hmm.
Though I'm still at a loss of how the nanoprobes worked and how they were removed. In Voyager, why didn't the writers cure the Blood Fever through death and resurrect the Vulcan with Borg probes? Of course, I don't think Shatner's universe was published at this point, but Voyager did use Borg probes for other things, so this is certainly plausible. All right.
So that's an interesting idea. I do like the idea of them actually killing somebody. You know, certainly the ending that they did was a huge cop-out. So I don't know if I like the idea of resurrecting someone with Borg probes, though. I'm a little uncomfortable with that. There was the bit in Battlestar Galactica where they just cured Rosalind's cancer with half-Cylon stem cells. And
yeah, I remember that.
Okay. It gets to the point where you're actually kind of relieved when the cancer comes back, because it was so ridiculous the way they cured it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, in this case, I mean, one reason why they didn't do that on here is that there were no Borg nanoprobes on Voyager at this point in time. I mean, this episode actually, at the very, very end of the episode, is where we first see a Borg of any kind on Voyager. So this was not even an option in Blood Fever.
Right.
Now, had this episode happened in season 6, for example, you know, after they had all their encounters with the Borg and Seven was on the ship, then, you know, maybe this would have been something that they might have tried.
Right. It's an interesting idea. I would have liked to see, again, we run the risk of being too much like a Mock Time. This is one of those things where, okay, you kill them and then bring them back. But at least in this case, you're not faking the death. You're actually having the person die. Although, didn't Voyager do that a couple times too? I seem to remember Harry Kim being killed and then brought back to life. At least once, if not twice, so.
Harry Kim perpetually dies.
Yes.
On the next Star Trek Voyager.
Previously on Star Trek Voyager, Harry Kim died. Now the conclusion, in which Harry Kim will die again.
Yes. They just have that like stock
yes.
footage that they can just throw in at the start of the episode, right? All right. So that was the one. The next one she wrote was about our show last week, Borg School Dropouts. And she said, I enjoyed the Borg dropout commentary, but I feel that Star Trek Enterprise is a solid series. So I would just say right there, I hope that Rebecca or any other listeners didn't misunderstand us on Enterprise last week, that, you know, Greg and I are actually quite big fans of
Enterprise. We are, yes, definitely.
She said, every series, in my view, is unique because it stands on its own. I think Star Trek Enterprise strikes a balance between originality and continuity. It is obvious that there are references to TNG and TOS, and in one episode, Commander Tucker asks if humans and Vulcans can mate. Well, I mean, was he in the decom chamber with the rub down in the first episode? I mean, he's been thinking ever since then, huh? I wonder if humans and Vulcans can mate.
Maybe so, we should try and see what happens.
Let's give that a shot. She says that the loss of infant Elizabeth, in my view, is one of the saddest moments in Enterprise. And I liked the original shows that provide some social commentary, in particular, Dear Doctor. And yeah, I'd agree. I mean, those were cases where Enterprise does what Star Trek does best.
Yeah, definitely.
As well. Which leads into the next part of her letter here. She says, I believe that Greg disliked the path Enterprise took in season 3. Personally, seasons 1, 2, and 4 were stronger for me, but the destruction of the weapon and introduction of the sphere builders was interesting, and I liked the subplot of the temporal Cold War, though it wasn't explained well. It is obvious why Enterprise focused on the Zindi. All commentary pointed to 9/11. I wish we could have a new series showing Archer as president and transitioning to the TOS era.
Well, yes, wasn't that the pilot you wrote for UPN, Space the West Wing?
Yeah, but they turned me down.
Yeah.
They I think the problem was that I had you review it before we sent it in, if you remember, and the feedback I got was that, you know, we like it, but there are just too many Battlestar Galactica references in the script.
I don't think that Porthos made a believable chief of staff.
Yeah, and I also think the White House is not ready for a chief of staff who has a bionic tail.
Probably not. Or thrusters and a warp drive.
Yeah. I would say here that I don't know. I think you and I are on the same page in terms of season 3 of Enterprise, mm-hmm. which is that as a standalone season, it's fine. I mean, as a story, the problem is that it was such a detour from the series yeah. and from what the series should have been doing that when you put it within the context of the series itself, it feels like they veered off track just to chase ratings for a season instead of doing what they should have been doing, which is what we saw in season 4.
Yeah, I mean, this is what Down in Front calls going to the mansion, which is where you sort of take this huge detour to do something that is completely different from the rest of the piece. I guess it's from 28 Days Later where they do go to a mansion and it becomes this whole commentary about the military. And yeah, while I like season 3 for the most part, because it's a detour, because it's so unlike the rest of the show, it disappoints me because it is such a huge portion of the show. It's a fourth of the show or more because it takes so long to resolve the issues presented that the show feels like it never was given a chance to get off on its own foot. And then it wasn't able to do another huge arc. So it feels like Enterprise was, you know, temporal Cold War, and then the Zindi, and then it was over. And that's frustrating for a series when all the other shows were allowed to be so many different things. You know, TNG had holodeck episodes. They had Romulan Klingon episodes. They had the Borg. Voyager became, you know, a new show several times. Enterprise didn't get a chance to really explore all of the different types of shows they could do. And That's just, it's disappointing because Enterprise is over and it's never actually going to happen anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's the case. And, you know, the other series really didn't get good until the third season anyway. It's just, it's a different era, you know. It's the fact that it was on a network and not syndication, and the fact that it was produced in the 2000s at a time when the networks were basically doing nothing but chasing ratings.
Yeah.
And at a time when ratings weren't reliable anymore because people are recording things, watching them later. People are viewing things online at that point already.
Yeah.
So,
I think if they had given 3 or 4 years before launching the new Star Trek show, if they let themselves be influenced by the other stuff that's coming out, you know, Battlestar came out, Stargate was doing good stuff. If they had made a show more like that later on, after people gotten a chance to be missing Star Trek, I think they could have even done Enterprise several years later and it would have been more popular.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, I would agree with that. To address a couple more items here that Rebecca mentioned, Temporal Cold War, I think we actually have done a whole show on Temporal Cold War. So if you're listening and you're interested in that and you didn't hear that show, if you just go back and I'll try to put a link in the show notes if I can remember to do that. But we do have a whole show that's just dedicated to the Temporal Cold War. We also did a whole show that's dedicated, it's kind of like an Enterprise retrospective as well. The Temporal Cold War, I think, was an interesting idea that just wasn't really explored. It was kind of just thrown in there because the studio wanted something futuristic to be in to the series. And then the Sphere Builders, I think we talked about them a little bit, didn't we, Greg?
I believe we did get to them. And it was an interesting idea, too. I mean, we sort of learned that the Zindi weren't the actual threat in the end.
Right, yeah.
And that was actually cool. I like the end of season 3.
Yes. Yeah, that was cool, but they didn't go anywhere with it.
Yeah, exactly.
So another disappointment there.
And then right from there into space Nazis. Good job, guys. Good job.
More Nazis. Every Star Trek series has to have Nazis on it at some point. Did DS9 have any Nazis? I think it's the only series that did not have Nazis.
I think so.
Did The Next Generation have Nazis? Maybe The Next Generation.
It might not have. It's possible. I'd have to go back and check. You know,
Voyager did. Voyager had like a 2-part Nazi episode, right? Where the Hirogen come on.
Yes, that was
the Killing Game.
Let's not
Nazi episode.
Talk
right?
about the Killing Game, man, or the Hirogen at all. No, who was it? I believe it was David Taylor, who's joining us for the feature today. Was tweeting about how Star Trek is Wagon Train to the Stars, I replied that I love that episode of Wagon Train where they go to the Nazi frontier town.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, thanks for writing in, Rebecca. And if anyone else wants to write in to us with some, you know, feedback like this, we may start doing a regular mailbag segment on the show as we get them in. All right, Greg, a couple more things quickly here in news. Shatner's World is coming to Broadway. Now, are you looking forward to seeing Shatner live on stage?
Shatner, he's the guy. I'm working on it.
I think that is the opening number. I'm not going to be able to see him, you know, being in Japan, but I am looking forward to getting the official Broadway cast recording of Shatner's World with that song.
Yeah, I mean, it's showing on Broadway for, what is it?
I think it's 17 or 20 shows altogether.
Right, and then they're going to hit the road. They're going to go around the country. I think they're coming to Seattle. I need to check and see if I can get tickets.
I'm pretty sure they are.
I believe I remember seeing that. So I'm really, really hoping I can see Shatner's World, although I don't know what it is. I mean, I guess it's going to be similar to one-man shows. Carrie Fisher did a one-woman show where she talks about, you know, living with her parents and in doing Star Trek and all of her various stories.
Doesn't Carrie Fisher, she talks about how
Star Wars
is so much
right?
better than Star Trek. Yeah. She went to Klingon or somewhere.
Right. Carrie Fisher. But I can't imagine that William Shatner will be more insufferable than Carrie Fisher. So,
no, I imagine it would be quite entertaining. Have you read or listened to his new book?
The Shatner Rules?
Shatner Rules, yeah.
I can't bring myself to do it.
Oh, you should. Get the audiobook version from Audible. And he's reading it. It's great. It's just, oh, I know people have all kinds of different feelings about Shatner, but ultimately for me, he's just entertaining. Just listening to him tell stories is entertaining. So I would certainly love to see this if they ever, I guess for me, we'll have to put it out on DVD. But
yeah, I'll have to give a look at it and see. I don't know. There's only so much Shatner I can take. I actually watched the entire run of Bleep My Dad Says, and I'm one of the only people who ever did actually watch that show. So maybe my Shatner tolerance is higher than I thought.
Maybe so.
I'm feeling where you're coming from. I'll always hear your voice telling me love is the only time. To me, you gotta be so fantastic. You make me feel fantastic.
All right, Greg. Well, you know, Chris Pine thinks some things are pretty fantastic, also,
yes,
as we jump into our fairly short movie news segment this week.
Yes. Chris Pine thinks everything is wonderful. You know, we talked about last week how Chris Pine is insufferable, and he's just proving it by pretending that things are fantastic on the set when everyone else
that's you, the rumor you're going to start, right? You want to start a rumor that Chris Pine is difficult to work with.
I've officially started this rumor, Chris. I'm now continuing the rumor. You know, you should have seen the other tweets from the other actors that didn't make it onto Trek News, where they're saying Chris Pine is sitting in his trailer with the green girl again, or Chris Pine only wants mint M&Ms. Yes. Chris Pine thinks he should be the one wearing the Vulcan ears. I don't even know where Chris Pine comes up with some of these things that he does on set, but from what I hear, production is not going well.
Now, do you have an inside source is where you're getting all this information?
I have several inside sources. Tribbles. Mainly Tribbles.
Now, is it true that the Tribbles in the Abramsverse are carnivorous?
They are. They have gigantic teeth, little beady eyes. Instead of cooing, they have more of a hoot, but pretty much the same. But yes. Yes, go on.
It's interesting that as the movie production, as we get further along, I think more and more news will come out. And we're kind of at the point right now where filming has started and people are kind of hungry to know what's going on. But yet there's really not a lot of news coming out. And so some of the stories that we get are kind of interesting that Chris Pine says it's fantastic. Now, what is fantastic about it? I don't know.
Right. Exactly.
One thing it reminds me here that could be fantastic, mm-hmm. Greg. Now, there was the whole thing about Benicio del Toro, and you know that deal fell through supposedly. Although I'm hearing now that maybe it didn't fall through, and that he actually is not going to be in the movie itself, but he's actually going to be involved in the production of the movie. Because is it true what I heard that Benicio del Toro is going to be playing Roberto Orsi on the set?
I did hear that, and Shia LaBeouf will be playing Alex Kurtzman.
Oh, boy, they're getting really creative in the casting on this movie.
They really are, yes. I believe Orsi tweeted some pictures, much-anticipated pictures, from the set of the Star Trek film. I clicked these, and I was very excited. I was waiting to see, you know, Alice Eve in uniform. I was going to see... you know, Benedict Cumberbatch and his Cybok hair. But I believe I was disappointed.
You were disappointed because this was going on Twitter, and Roberto Orsi was saying that, oh, if I get 10,000 followers by the end of the day, I will tweet a photo from the set. And I don't know if he got to 10,000 followers or not. When I checked, he still needed about 500.
I think he might have lost some followers after this.
I don't know. But, well, yeah, after everything was said and done, because this was all played up, you know, well, he's going to tweet a photo. And so then some photos came out. It's like, oh, my God, photos from the set of Star Trek. Oh, I can't wait. Oh, wait, These are from the last
right,
film.
Exactly.
But still, oh my God.
Right.
And then my head hit the desk.
Yeah. Well, I saw a quote.
Why
somebody
is he tweeting photos from the last, this is what, 3 years ago now?
Well, it's like that company that said it was going to give away a Toyota to the top sales associate. And when the person finally did it, they gave her a toy Yoda from Star Wars.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, people love this sort of joke. You know, it goes over real well. Yeah, did you see a quote? Somebody asked J.J. Abrams about it. And J.J. was like, I don't know what Roberto was doing. We haven't released anything. There's no reason. It's like, what? Okay.
Oh, well, but this is the news that we're getting.
Yes.
From this set.
They were interesting pictures. I liked seeing them. I hadn't seen them before. So there's that at least. But they unfortunately were not from the new film.
Right. I think it was just the expectation that we were going to get to see a photo. I would rather see one photo from the set of the new movie than however many this was from the last one. But
I'm trying to remember what the first images we saw from the first Abramsverse film were. I think it was pictures from the set of the Starfleet Academy. They had pictures of some of like the cars and extras in the cadet uniforms. And that was, I believe they were unofficial. They were sort of spy pictures. Now, I haven't seen anything like that from this film yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything either. So, Greg, it looks like we have just one more thing in movie news today.
Really? Is this true? All right.
So what do we have? What's our last thing in movie news today, Greg?
We actually have a heartwarming tale, Chris, of a lost Russian tourist who found his way onto the Paramount lot. Now, Chris, was he looking for the nuclear vessels?
I do believe he was looking for the nuclear vessels.
Didn't he realize they're in Alameda?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so apparently...
I believe we've lost Chris. What happened is a Russian tourist came onto the set. He was lost. Anton Yelkin, who is fluent in Russian, he actually is... Have you heard him speak Russian before, Chris? He's fantastic. That accent he's putting on, I mean, he's putting it on, but it is like a true Russian accent with the Star Trek twist.
With the Star Trek twist, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, apparently I just heard from somewhere that this Russian tourist accidentally wandered onto the set and Yelkin helped them find their way out by pulling up a diagram of the building and locating the exit and pointing and saying, "Nu volt."
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to see you, Walter Koenig, and Anton Yelkin try to carry on a conversation in Russian.
Oh man. So all right, I guess we should actually say that this did not happen. This is just something that we imagined happened in an alternate universe, because there just wasn't a lot of movie news this week. And as we call the segment Movie News and Rumors,
yes, exactly.
That would fall under the rumors, untrue rumors category.
I'm sorry. Yes, this news story brought to you by Christopher Jones. I guess we could have talked about Zoe Saldana helping the cat across the road or whatever the story was.
Yes.
I heard that Spot the Cat got a DOI this week.
Oh, that reminds me now. We didn't mention this, but of course the Avery Brooks actually did apparently get cited for a DUI. And I heard that he claimed that it was a Ketracel White that he had consumed too much of.
I just heard that, you know, similar to his performance in The Pale Moonlight, he just blamed it all on the Dominion.
It's always their fault. Klingons have come to be known as the primary Star Trek villain over the course of the franchise history. And before there was Worf or Gorkon or Chang or even Captain Claw, there was Kor, who appeared in Errand of Mercy, the first ever appearance of the Klingons on Star Trek. And today we'll talk about Errand of Mercy. And of course, I have Greg with me. And joining us this week is David Taylor, who many of our listeners know from Twitter as Sci-Fi Core. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I believe David hails actually from the Seattle metro area, as I do. That's right. You're right up the street somewhere.
That is. Yep. I'm just on the east side of Seattle.
Right. So this is the closest I've been to a panelist since I was in the same room with Chris back in August.
That's right. Very true. Oh, David, before we get started here, now I know this happened last summer, but I just wanted to ask you firsthand. I was really impressed. I'm a designer and I work in marketing and all. And I was really impressed with your campaign to get yourself sent to Star Trek Las Vegas by Jim Beam. How did you come up with that idea and how did you pull that off?
You know, it's funny. It started just as a joke on Twitter. Somebody had suggested that I go to the Star Trek convention, and I said, no, you know, I don't have enough money. Maybe next time. And I put a hashtag, Jim Beam Me Up. Or I said, maybe I need a sponsor. You know, Jim Beam Me
right.
Up.
There you go.
And then a little bit later, I thought, you know, that's actually a pretty good idea. And found Jim Beam's Twitter account. And, you know, started posting some kind of jokey, you know, send me to the Star Trek convention. And then I got a note back that said, you know, we see you. I'll check into it. Don't get your hopes up. And I thought, oh, my gosh, they see me. And then I went all out.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then I went all out and was designing the posters and stuff. And they took notice and the Elster. It was early in the morning and I woke up and like, holy crap, they're doing it. I couldn't believe it. It surprised me as much as anyone else, I think.
Wow. Yeah, it was amazing. It was very impressive. I really enjoyed watching it unfold. And it's amazing that you got someone like that, a big company like that, to latch on to it and actually send you there.
That's what impressed me about it too. You know, just it shows the power of social media. You know, just one guy way down here, I think at the time had, you know, 200 followers maybe, and I was able to get their attention and create something.
Nice. Have you been working on a follow-up? Like, I don't know, he's dead, Jim Bean, something like that?
No, but I did just recently do a photo shoot. I got a real photographer and a real model. A gal in California who's, she makes costumes, mostly corsets. You may have seen the Star Trek corsets online at some point.
Actually, I think Greg has those. Didn't you order some of those, Greg?
And I'll give her a plug. It's eveningarwin.com. And Becky Jordan is the name of the gal that owns it. And I reached out to her and told her what I wanted to do. And she agreed to make a corset. The original series corset and right. Shipped it up to me and we did a photo shoot and I've put a couple of little things out and there's a lot more, photos to go through.
So is it going to be a calendar? Like I'm thinking like a day or year calendar of some sort.
I think eventually I'd like to make a science fiction calendar. Not specifically Star Trek, but, you know, sexy girls parodying famous sci-fi movies. The next one that I've got grinding away in my head is Forbidden Planet. I'd love to see a sexy, you know, the gray uniforms that they have.
Yeah.
I can just picture a sexy version of that on a cute pinup. I think it would be hilarious.
That's fantastic. Yeah, this could be a coffee table book even.
It could.
See this going many directions. All right.
All right. Sounds interesting. All right, cool. Well, let's jump into Aaron Mercy here. And it's our first appearance of the Klingons, who I always find it interesting that when you think about the original series and villains, you know, you think of the Klingons. Oh, yeah, the Klingons, they're the Star Trek villains. There's the Federation and there's the Klingons. But, you know, if you include the Cage, there are 80 episodes of the original series, and the Klingons only appeared in 7 episodes.
Right.
And even those were not Klingon stories necessarily. The Klingons just happened to be there for a moment. So there really weren't a lot of Klingons on the original series. But yet, you know, and thanks to this episode especially, you think of Kor and you think of Klingons as the big enemy.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a part of that, or a lot of that, comes from also the films that were pretty much exclusively Klingons. Every time you think of Shatner going up against an enemy, it's either Khan or it's, you know, Captain Klaw or Klang or Kor or Koloth or one of those other K-villains.
The K-villains, yeah.
Yeah, Kirk goes up against a lot of other Ks. I don't know if that was planned or not.
Well, you know, that's they've said in Star Trek with the names that it's always a hard consonant, like
yes.
K or T, or mm-hmm. you have Riker, you have Tiberius, you have Kirk. It's always, you have to have this very strong consonant in there. And I guess at some point they decided that Klingons like to use K to start their names. That's why they're Klingons.
Right. I always thought Romulans had a lot more variety to their names. What was the name of the guy in, what's the episode where Geordi falls into the pit? It's the one right after Booby Trap.
That's the enemy, I believe.
Yes, the enemy.
The name of the guy, I don't actually remember.
I believe it's Bahra, which I thought was a pretty good name for a bad guy. It's got a nice little...
I thought Bahra was a famous composer.
Johann Sebastian Bahra. Yes.
That's right.
Famous Romulan composer.
Yes.
You've never heard Bahra until you've heard it in the original Romulan.
Exactly. Right. But no, I was surprised by the Klingons in this episode. I want to hear from our guest panelist, David. What did you think of the first appearance of the Klingons?
I thought they were great. I'm going to talk about it as I watched it as a kid. I remember being young and watching the Klingons march out through the courtyard and thinking, wow, that's really cool. You know, these are some badass dudes. And I feel like this, as their first appearance in Star Trek, it really set in stone what Klingons were. And I don't know if, you know, how they evolved before that, you know, what Gene Roddenberry had in mind, or I don't even know if Gene Roddenberry invented the Klingons. Who wrote this episode? Do you know?
The episode was written by Gene L. Coon.
Okay.
As for the actual genesis of the Klingons themselves, you know, I don't know who all was involved in that specifically.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of records from the writer's room from the original series, so it's hard to say exactly.
Yeah.
But just them as this, you know, another empire that seems like the ultimate enemy of the Federation. And as a kid growing up, you know, I was afraid of the Russians. You know, we thought the Russians might bomb us.
Right.
And to me, I think that's what resonated, that these are the bad guys. We don't know much about them. And it was interesting how warlike they were, mm-hmm. but how much like us they were. And it mm-hmm. made me think about, you know, roles of good and bad. And
right.
It was just really interesting.
It is very much in this episode, kind of this parallel between the United States and democracy and the Soviet Union and communism. And of course, it's a time when the Soviet Union was trying to export communism, you know, around the globe. And there was that power struggle between freedom and democracy and communism. But then you have that line from Kor, who tells Kirk that, you know, basically we're very similar to each other, you know. And Kirk says something like, you know, we're a democracy, we're freedom, and you like to conquer and kill. And Kor tells him, well, I'm not talking about, you know, little ideological differences. You know, we are similar as a species. But of course, then he goes on to say that, you know, we're similar in that we like to kill and fight and conquer the universe and all. And then and Kirk doesn't really rebut that too much, does he?
Yeah.
Well, I think in other episodes, Kirk's even, you know, admitted to that. You know, we're barbarians, yes, but yes, we won't kill. We won't kill today.
Not today, you know? Maybe tomorrow, but yeah.
Well, like the Netflix description, maybe it's the Memory Alpha description, but it talks about how the Enterprise goes to save the Organians from the Klingons, but that's not really at all what they were there for. They were there because Organia has a strategic location, and they want to control it.
And that was part of my thinking of why they completely disregarded the Prime Directive.
Right.
Was because it was, you know, here we are at war. Obviously, the Prime Directive isn't prime. You know, maybe the secondary directive.
Right. Yeah, apparently, if you're at war and you really, really want this planet, it doesn't matter if you completely destroy their culture.
Exactly. Right.
Although, they're not at
war. Always fair in love and war.
Yeah. They're not at war at the beginning of the episode, though. The war suddenly breaks out as they're, you know, flying to the planet. Kirk's like,
right,
oh, there it is. We didn't want it, but it's here. It's war.
Yeah. We blew up their ship. Yeah. I guess we started the war.
War.
Whoops.
It's amazing how fast news travels, they did, too, right? They? It's like, you know, we don't really like you guys too much. Wait a minute. You blew up one of our ships somewhere out in space.
Right.
We've declared war right now. Right. It happens so quickly. It is interesting here in the Prime Directive. I was trying to remember, when did the Prime Directive first come up in Star Trek? And it actually came up a few episodes before this.
Really?
The Return of the Archons, I think, is the first time the Prime Directive is mentioned.
Is that Landru?
That's Landru, yeah.
All right.
We all love Landru.
How did they define the Prime Directive when they introduced it?
It's just this kind of general, we cannot intervene in alien cultures.
Okay. Well, they sort of blatantly disregard that because they sort of beam down into the courtyard. You know?
I know.
It's like, hi, we're space aliens. We're from space.
They just beam down and there are the goats around. Whose castle is this?
Right.
Right?
Take us to your leader. They literally say, take us to your leader, you know?
Right. Oh, and they say like, you'd think they have people beaming down every day. They don't seem to mind that we just beam down here.
Maybe they were showing off, a show of force.
Right.
Yeah.
Fear us.
But the Prime Directive, it was obviously new at this point. I mean, this is the, I think, the 26th episode of the first season, the very long first season of the original series. And the Prime Directive had been mentioned twice. It was also in A Taste of Armageddon, obviously, with the two planets are, you know, fighting this computer war with each other. So here it comes up again, in the sense that they are obviously not caring about the Prime Directive. And I was noticing all the lines, you know, between Kirk and Spock, and they're talking about, Spock tells Kirk, oh, we were mistaken. This is not the agricultural culture that it seems. And I'm thinking, he's going to say that, you know, it turns out they are actually more advanced. But it's like, they're actually completely stagnant. They haven't gone anywhere in hundreds and hundreds of years. And then Kirk's like, well, we got to take over this planet.
Exactly. Like,
well, this should be easy then.
Right, exactly. Like, it's at no point are they thinking, I mean, okay, they present it as, we've got to save these people from the Klingons, but they're presenting it as, you people are so backwards. Why don't you understand why we're so awesome and why you ought to think we're awesome and why we ought to put up defenses on your planet and take it over and totally be your overlords?
Yes.
You know, that's an interesting point because, you know, if you think about what America, and I wasn't alive when these aired, but if you think about what America was about back then, you know, did we have this overwhelming desire to make everyone one of us? You know, the idea that anybody wouldn't want to be like America back then.
Well, it's, I mean, not even, just back then. It goes on today.
Yeah, I mean, look at what we've done in Afghanistan and in Iraq. You know, supposedly they welcomed us with bracket. But basically, you know, we're trying to build schools and all this stuff. And, you know, they didn't want all of that. You know, the women there don't want to drive. a lot of them. They don't want to not wear burkas. They're kind of, and you know, whatever.
That's their way.
It's their culture. Like, what are we to do to tell them they ought to be like Americans, even if it is strategically important?
We're America.
Exactly.
Well, see, I'll tell you from someone who watches it from outside, because I've lived most of my adult life in Japan, so I always see it from the outside. That you know, there is this impression. You talk about this episode being timely. A great thing about the original series is so many of the messages were timely in their time in the late 60s, and they're still timely now. I mean, they still play the role now.
Yeah.
If you just look at Egypt, if you look at Iraq, if you look at Syria, things going on right now, there is this impression from the outside of the United States that the U.S. thinks that all the world wants to be like them.
Yeah.
That everyone wants to have American-style democracy, that everyone wants to have the same entertainment and wants to do everything the same way, and that the U.S. will go in either militarily or through diplomatic channels and kind of transform each little corner of the world so that it would be like them. And that's what you see here in this episode is totally the message that Kirk delivers about the Federation, that, you know, you guys are agricultural and just, you know, you don't have any technology, and we're going to come in and we're going to make your lives better. We're going to make you like the Federation. We're going to make you we're going to give you the technology and show you how to grow more food and so forth. And so the prime directive, which is to not to interfere with the natural development of a society, unless they're at that bizarre cutoff point of having warp technology, and then suddenly it's okay to mess around with other cultures as long as they can fly a spaceship around. It's totally on display in this episode. It's when you think about Star Trek, the 45 plus years of Star Trek we have now and how the idea of prime directive has evolved, it's really interesting to watch this episode and see the early stages and how the Federation is approaching a culture that they believe is like a medieval village, basically.
Yeah. And it's interesting that this is a case of sort of Roddenberry's message. I'm sort of blanket saying Roddenberry, you know, all the producers, it was the idea of the show, but Roddenberry's message coming through not from the perspective of these futuristic humans who live in this utopian society. You know, this is a case of where the humans are still extremely flawed. You know, we fast forward to the next generation, and this is a speech Picard would have been making, not the head of the Council of Elders who's not in charge. It would have been Picard saying, you know, we shouldn't have the war and all this stuff.
Right. During a staff meeting, right?
During a staff meeting.
Yes. In my ready room.
Right.
But where I was going with that I think I may not have been very clear on, is in the time that this was made, it was trying to democratize other cultures around the world to counteract the threat of the Soviets, because it was like a balance. Like, if they convert too many countries to communism, then they're going to have the upper hand, where we have to convert more countries to democracy, so we have the upper hand. Whereas today, you don't really have that in terms of America. You don't have that threat from communism so much anymore. But yet, the practice still continues, is kind of where I was going with that.
Interesting.
So they beam down. Anyway, they're down at the planet, and Aelborn comes out.
And his arms wide open.
His arms wide open, right. And then when he takes them in there and they're in the council room, the only thing I'm thinking is he's like saying, "Hi, I'm King Arthur, and these are my knights of the round table." Right?
Yes. It's very much that. I mean, it's like their Arab village backlot from the Paramount, but it very much feels like King Arthur's court and the castle, the big door. Because
it so looked council. Reused. Yes. Yeah, right. You know, it just screamed, "Oh, we'll just throw these pieces together. You know, it'll look good.
It'll look good." Right. Yeah, don't worry about it. No one's ever going to see this in like high definition or anything like
right.
that.
Hi, what? Nobody will even have a big screen, a TV bigger than...
Yeah.
No one will ever need a TV larger than 14 inches.
Right.
But Greg, I think you told me you were a little concerned that like a flying cow was going to come over the top of the castle, right?
And I was. Your mother smells of elderberries is all I could think of. It was a little, you know, this is what you talk about, Chris, how the original series sort of balances this deep message with a very cheesy production design, which we can just go on and talk about for a while.
Yes.
The spray painted goats, the air mattress on the floor of the dungeon. I think I mentioned that the Klingon makeup was basically they pasted on fake mustaches and then had them go clean chimneys for a while.
Yes, and then come back in and shoot the scene, right? But we have to remember that it's especially cheesy to us now. At the time it was made, it was less so. But it's a challenge. Now, David, let me ask you, related to this, how do you mm-hmm. feel about the remastered project of the original series? I think you're about the same age as me. You grew up watching the original series in its original cut, you know, long before there was any idea of remastering
right,
yeah. it. So you're
I'm 41 now. So I grew up with the reruns.
The reruns of the original series, right? Yeah. But long before there was any Next Generation, right? So are you a purist or how do you feel about this whole remastering?
I guess I'm a purist. I don't have any problem with them remastering. You know, I don't feel like they've destroyed, you know, something.
Yeah.
But there was something for me. Star Trek was so emotional. It was, you know, a comfort show. You know, if I was feeling bad, I could put in Star Trek. It was a feeling, and the effects. The cheesy effects, the graininess of the ship, mm-hmm. you know, as it flew out of frame, that was a part of that feeling. And mm-hmm. if it's up to me, it's hard to find the original cut now. I mean, on Netflix they have the remastered version. I want to see the old one, though. I will say I love seeing the remastered. You know, characters, you know, the,
right.
the live action. And I can understand how difficult that would be to remaster it and then have these, you know, I mean, they'd look even worse,
yeah.
you know, these bad special effects.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is not to say anything bad about the CG artists at work, but I don't think CBS put the money into the effects that they should have.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. You know, it looks like, no offense to the people that did it. Yeah. I mean, maybe they were students, but it looks like students
yeah.
did it.
Well, the thing with effects is it's all about the amount of money that the studio puts into it. The artists are capable of amazing things, but if they're only given a certain amount of time, they could only do so high quality of work. And the guy who was made to do the Enterprise model wasn't given enough time. There's not enough detail on it. It doesn't look like a starship. It looks like a cheap CG model. And it's frustrating because I know they could do so much better. We've seen from the Next Gen project what you can do when you just clean up the original film. And I don't know how possible that was with the original series, but there must have been a better option than they went down.
Well, right there, I mean, you talk about what they're doing with the Next Generation. I mean, the level of detail there, you know, there's that shot where from the backside of the ship and there are the windows right there. And you can see the three guys walking by and they're all wearing scants and they have like all three division colors going by. I mean, that's a kind of detail that I just really wasn't expecting them to
exactly.
put in.
I'd never noticed that. That's great.
The reason I ask you about remastered is because What I love about the original series is that the stories were largely written by well-known science fiction writers. They mm-hmm. have wonderful messages behind them that still ring true all these decades later. I think for the modern audience, you know, David, people like us especially, and Greg, who's a little bit younger than us, are kind of okay with watching the original effects and following the story, you know, and we're kind of fine with that. But so much of the modern audience, I think, is so accustomed to this high quality CG that you get in movies on television now that I think that the stories of the original series easily get lost on people because they're so fixated on how bad the sets are, how bad the props are, how bad the visuals are. So
wait. What do you mean bad? It's not funny. I don't even see it anymore. It's so iconic in my mind.
Yeah, right. But I'm speaking in terms of someone who is, say, 18 years old right now, trying to watch this. To them, they're looking at it and they're saying, "Gosh, it's so bad." You know, like my wife won't watch the original series even, and she's the same age as me. But she sees it as it's all very, very cheesy.
Well, I mean,
so I think that the remastered is important to make these stories accessible to modern audience.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to an old show, like, okay, the original Battlestar Galactica, Lost in Space, those are shows with cheesy production values and terrible scripts. Mm-hmm. Star Trek looks like those shows, but has really good scripts. Mm-hmm. But when people see
wait a second. I thought I just heard you say that Battlestar Galactica was a terrible show.
The original Battlestar Galactica was a terrible show.
What?
Have you seen it? Have you seen the original Battlestar?
Yes.
Were we having this argument? I think we were. They go to a casino planet. There is a robot dog.
So did Buck Rogers.
There is Muffet's a boy named Boxy with a Beatles haircut.
No, he was in the new show.
I won't say that all about the original Battlestar Galactica was bad, because there actually are some stories in the new one that are basically lifted right out of the original series and retold. But there were those moments, yes.
But my point is people see the cheesy sets and they associate in their mind with the terrible films of those years, the terrible TV, the worst TV shows of those years.
We're going to get a lot of hate mail from this episode, aren't we?
Feel free. Hey, they're not going to cancel Lost in Space because of me. It's long gone. But, you know, the thing about Star Trek is the reason Star Trek has stood the test of time is because those scripts and the performances are there. A show like the one we're doing, Errand of Mercy, isn't a show you're going to find from one of the other shows. And as you say, to get that newer audience to actually sit down and watch it, it's really hard. I think because of that production value. It's a lot easier to convince someone to watch DS9 or the new Battlestar Galactica because the production value's there and they're more willing to just go and watch it and see if the story is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're dead on that, you know, Star Trek back then, you know, as a science fiction show, it was so different from anything else that was on at the time. It had those stories and it had, you know, I mean, there was an awful lot of techno babble, but, you know, it on the whole, it kind of made sense. And I think it gained an audience because of that and the stories. And that's why it is still relevant today.
Yeah.
And that's why Battlestar Galactica and Buck Rogers are just kind of kitsch. You know, it's fun to go back and watch them. Some of us still enjoy them.
One of these days, I'll go back and watch the original one.
Yeah.
Buck Rogers went to a casino planet, too, and they went to a casino planet in The Next Generation.
They did.
Okay.
Just because it was a casino planet doesn't mean that it was bad.
Neither of those shows is about a post-apocalyptic society.
But the question is, on those other shows, a ragtag fleet
traveling through the cosmos looking for Earth, and they'll stop at Vegas. Yes, Chris.
On those other shows, did they have to win enough money to buy the casino back so that they could leave? Now, see, that's the question.
I think the Royale is, as terrible as the Royale is, it is better than any other casino show I've seen.
But I love the Royale, actually.
You do love the Royale. I don't understand.
I love that episode. I don't know. It's just something about how cheesy it is that I love that episode. All right. Well, okay. So we talked about the landing in here and talking to the Organians. And now, I found it interesting that Kor didn't know who Kirk, he didn't recognize Kirk.
Right.
He thinks Kirk's this Organian guy. But later when King Arthur reveals to them that this is Captain Kirk.
He is, you know, Captain Federation. James T. Kirk.
Yeah. That's right. And then Kor goes, Captain of the Enterprise. I'm like,
and
wait a
minute. First officer.
I know. It's like, okay, so you know,
right?
You know the Enterprise, of course, and it's Captain Kirk. But you don't recognize him. I mean, don't you have like space photos that go around or something?
And isn't the Enterprise in orbit I mean, or yes, it was
right.
In orbit.
The Enterprise
at least.
Is in orbit.
Yeah, they'd even be thinking about that.
Okay, so you see the Enterprise in orbit, and then you go to the planet, and you see this guy who's acting completely different from everyone else. Maybe you check your little Klingon iPad and see, and, you know, check Klingon Wikipedia.
Kor's looking at Spock. It's like, I thought you might be the first officer. No, he's a traitor in Kivos and Trillium. That couldn't be him. Spock's not a traitor.
Well, Spock did manage to withstand the mind scanner.
Oh, and did I mention our mind scanner?
The mind scanner.
I don't think you've mentioned the mind scanner yet.
No, I think we have a mind scanner.
Does Kor have a mind scanner?
Would you like to meet the mind scanner?
They're going to use the mind scanner very soon.
You could just tell me what I want to know, or, you know, we could use our mind scanner.
It would rip through your brain. Yes.
That's what our mind scanner does. Did I mention our mind scanner?
So Kor talks about the mind scanner a lot, is what Chris is trying to say.
My goodness.
And we never got to see it.
I know. I mean, what is it? From Mirror Mirror, we see the, what do they call it?
The agonizer booth.
I wanted to see the mind scanner. They kept bringing it up. It's one of those things. You can't, it's like the polar bear from last week's episode. You can't talk about something and then not actually show it on screen, because I'm going to be spending the whole episode thinking about where it is and what it looks like.
Where? I know. Yeah. They're like, this was last week. We talked about regeneration. So the Borg have boarded the Enterprise out in space somewhere, and Greg is still going, is the polar bear going to be on the corridors in the Enterprise? Where's the polar bear?
It's very true.
Oh, gosh. Anyway, so the mind scanner is, so it's a Klingon thing here, but as we go through Star Trek, isn't it the Romulans who end up having the mind scanner all the time in Star Trek? The Klingons, don't use mind scanners.
It's a very un-Klingon thing. I mean, this is where we talk about the difference between the TOS Klingons and the, whatever you call the 90s Star Trek Klingons, where these guys are much more the crafty villains that the Romulans ended up being. And they don't talk as much about honor. They're not as bloodthirsty. I mean, I guess they kill or try to kill 200 Organians in the city square.
They're just cardboard cutout warriors at this point. There's no honor. The culture that we know as the Klingons was a next generation invention, actually,
right
at that point. And yeah, we talked about this before, David, that the Klingons and the Romulans kind of flipped as the series goes. This is actually something that Larry Nemechek and Ira Stephen Bear talk about on their Blu-ray commentary for The Undiscovered Country, that the Romulans and the Klingons roles in Star Trek flip as time goes on. And the Romulans become more like the bureaucratic Russians, the Soviets.
That's interesting. What was the episode? It was basically the submarine episode with the
Balance
Romulans.
Of Terror. Yeah.
Balance of Terror. Yeah, that was very Klingon-ish. You know, honor and service.
Yes, exactly.
I'd never really thought of that before. That's interesting.
Yeah, so this definitely could be done as just a Romulan episode. And I think it would make a little bit more sense to our way of thinking of those races nowadays. When you go back and you imagine if they remade this as one of those Abramsverse comics, and the Klingons had the head ridges and they were more like new style Klingons, it wouldn't make an awful lot of sense. For them to sort of stroll in there and be like, oh, this is so much fun. I'm now your leader, and you'd better listen to my rules. I'm going to post a list of rules on the city square and get a liaison. When is the last time you heard a Klingon use the word liaison?
Right.
I need someone to liaise, please.
Let me ask you this now. Am I the only person, when Kor starts going through the list of rules with Kirk, am I the only person who had a Big Bang Theory flashback here? It's like Sheldon and Leonard's roommate agreement.
Right.
It's like, Kor is like, we shall give 12 hours notice before the gathering of hostages, and goat painting may only be conducted on Saturdays between 10 and 2. It's like this whole long, and if you go, I'm sure on the HD version, you can freeze the frame, or you can like go to Trek Kor and you can see in the HD stills, you can actually see that list of, rules and regulations on camera. But it's like a formal, it reminds me, like in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, especially in the movie version, the more recent movie version, the Vogons are like these bureaucratic, you know, you have to,
right.
Everything has to be notarized, you know, everything is, it's kind of like that. It's like this formal document that's been drawn up by some, you know, office on Kronos and notarized and sent in. It's just so un-Klingon-like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was, something has been going around Twitter and Facebook recently about how we never see slave races anymore, or how we just don't see it on Star Trek. How you don't see slave races on Klingon starships or Romulan starships, and you really should. And this is an episode that I pointed out as, well, here's an example of what the Klingons do, at least, when they take over a planet. Mm-hmm. And it's something we don't really see again that I can think of.
Not really.
Unless
you count the Bajorans, but we don't see them being slaves, right. Except in a few flashback episodes.
Right, right. So it's an interesting idea. I mean, you imagine this is going on all the time, especially since the Federation only cares if it's a planet that's strategically important. Assumedly, the clans are going around and just subjugating left and right. And you know, this is Kor's planet, but over there's Kolos' planet. And, you know, if B'Elanna hadn't been born to in the Federation, she probably would have had her own planet back in the Klingon Empire. Just imagine everybody gets to be a commandant for a year.
Well, if there's a lot of planets, you'd have to have a lot of leaders.
Exactly. Right.
But yeah, I thought it was funny that they had a the special occupation order number 4.
Yeah.
Yes. It's like all laid out. You know, it's like, oh, special occupation order number 4.
Oh, yeah, they've got this down to a science, apparently. They know exactly how to subjugate, how to quell rebellion.
Yeah. Well, like you said, they've probably done it a lot.
Exactly.
Well, Elborn in the council, look at it. Well, all the paperwork seems to be in order. So.
Right.
Can we make an announcement? Let's just tell everybody that we're now subjects of the Klingon Empire.
Right.
As a kid, I remember being just almost as disgusted as Kirk and Kor at these guys, these pacifists. And I thought it was, I mean, the idea of being a pacifist just like freaked me out as a kid. Mm. And as I've gotten older, I think I lean more towards that. And I think Star Trek has something to do with that. But the idea that these guys in Kirk and Kor's mind would just sit there and just let this happen. And Kor was just disgusted with these people. Kirk was disgusted with them. The idea that I'm not sure where I was going with that, but.
Mm. But Well, the thing is, okay, so the show keeps in its back pocket the whole thing where they're actually energy beings, which is a very sort of something Star Trek goes to a lot. But
unidentified energy being of the week, yes. Right?
I mean, but what if these guys...
It's an easy effect.
Right, exactly. But what if these guys hadn't been energy beings? What if they had actually just been pacifists and just actually had just been like, okay, we're going to be subjects of the Klingons until they go away. That actually might have actually been a more powerful thing, but that's what you think is happening for most of the episode, where these people are just actually going to sit back and let themselves become slaves of the Klingons and not do anything.
Yeah,
and I'm sure it's nothing the Klingons have ever come up against.
They drop a few clues here and there.
They do.
That these guys have some kind of power beyond what we're seeing. But it is pretty subtle, and you know, the first time you watch this through, the ending, the revelation that they are these energy beings, it does come as a bit of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I think it kind of undercuts the message. I mean, that's fine for energy beings, you know, they can be all pacifists and stuff, but you know, we're humans and we actually bleed, and we need to go to war.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess
I don't think you could have had the Kirk and Kor. I think the powerful part of that was Kirk and Kor arguing for war.
Yes.
And I think that's what gets me is, and I haven't really put my finger on it, but there's this core part of us that we want to be so free, that we would choose this conflict over someone telling us what to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's just really odd.
Yeah, it's an interesting scene where Kirk and Kor are standing next to each other, and Kirk is saying, we have legitimate grievances. And King Arthur just sort of says, you don't have legitimate enough grievances to be, killing millions of each other. I mean, you think of World War One and Two, or the Civil War in America, where tons and tons of people died, and for what in the end? However much we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. An awful lot of people died just so one side could prove that they won the war and therefore could put their stamp on the future. It's I don't know. It's something we as a culture, as a society, haven't moved past. And, Kirk hasn't either by the 23rd century. So I don't know if there's any hope for us.
It is quite a contrast, you mentioned Kirk there, between what we see in The Next Generation with Picard in the way of thinking versus Kirk here. And you mentioned earlier, Greg, how these humans, we talk on here when we talk about Enterprise, how the humans in Enterprise are very much like us. And then the humans in the original series are still flawed, even though it was the series, it was the original series, Gene's original vision of what Star Trek would be in the future. Although I think that The Next Generation is closer to his actual vision of the future.
Right.
You still have these flawed here and how that would evolve as you get to The Next Generation. Because, you would never see Picard arguing for war with Gowron the way that Kirk and Kor are here.
Yeah. Not in a million years.
Well,
he does. Fact that they're allies. Maybe Riker. Now, he'd be arguing with Gowron over who's going to get the woman over there.
Right. Well, so the Organians, it's an interesting thing that happens. The my favorite part of the episode is when the humans and the clans just go at each other and then are completely unable to. It's like they'd gotten to the point where words weren't good enough. Words aren't good enough for us anymore. We start fighting. It's like that moment in a musical, where the words aren't good enough for your emotions, so you start singing. But in here, they start fighting. And the Organians completely don't allow them to. And I guess it forces them to start talking again. But what's crazy and what makes me think so hard every time I actually go back and watch this episode is, why didn't they just keep talking? Because obviously they were capable of talking the whole time. And I think that's the core of the message of this show is, you can always talk more. And what's so wrong with talking? Because obviously you could have kept talking.
Well, they kept talking on the first season of Enterprise and the ratings went down. So. <It's good. laughs> but yeah, I agree that that's the strong message there. And the Organians themselves. Now, another thing about this episode is that it actually has kind of far-reaching consequences for Star Trek in a way. In that you have the Organian peace treaty that is imposed on the Klingons and the Federation at this point to prevent them from fighting. And I believe King Arthur here actually tells them that in the future, you guys are going to work together. You're going to be friends and you're going to work together. And of course, that comes true in the Next Generation era. And then it's kind of bumpy, but it works out for the most part for them.
It's funny watching that episode where everybody, heats up to 350 degrees when they try to, touch their weapons. Or in the new Klingons of the Next Generation, I think they would have taken the hit. They wouldn't have let 350 degrees stop them from fighting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It would have been dishonorable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, these Klingons are very much closer to humans than the Klingons of later series. So, I think that was actually, that was something said in Memory Alpha, was the makeup person said that they used Klingon so much because it was much easier to do the Klingon makeup than the Romulan makeup.
Yeah, which I find interesting.
Yeah.
When you look at the Romulans and the Klingons of the original series, the Romulan makeup doesn't look particularly complicated either.
It's really not.
Yeah.
I guess you have to get those helmets for everybody so you don't have to do the ears. But you have to do ears on at least one of them just to prove that they are, in fact, a Romulan.
Yeah, just show a little ear.
Now, you mentioned the Organian Peace Treaty. So any idea, once you're, say you leave Organia and you're out floating around in space and you get into a fight with a Klingon, how do the Organians know that you're fighting with a Klingon?
That one old guy, he senses it. He says, like, these two ships are fighting in the other quadrant.
Right.
And
light them up.
And then all the control panels on both ships heat up to 350 degrees. So
damn it,
can
they
press
got
buttons.
Us. They got us.
Yeah.
Everybody would be wearing
right.
of
exactly.
gloves.
Exactly. Just have to wear gloves.
Both the Federation and the Klingon Empire developed these, like, really, really heat-resistant gloves that are standard issue on all uniforms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a recurring joke we have on the show, but here it's actually true. There is a non-canon novel that actually explains this. Amazingly enough, one of these books explains that the Organians' powers only work in their own solar system. So when he said, "I'm standing on, you know, San Francisco mm-hmm. and on Kronos," that was a bluff, that he wasn't actually doing that, that the only control he had were over the Klingons there and around in the system. And then
I'd believe that was a bluff because he didn't seem like he was really speaking to the to the world or worlds.
Yeah, he really didn't.
I would have been a little more impressive. And I was wondering, do you think the people when he appeared there, do you think they saw everybody else that was in the room, like see Kirk standing there in his
yeah, I don't know. That line is kind of confusing because he's like, "I'm also standing on Earth." Like, well, where are you standing on Earth? Are you like talking to the president? Why aren't we seeing that scene? Like, that seems much more interesting than what's going on here.
Watch out for the polar bear.
Yeah, I mean, depending on where he is, he could be near a polar
bear.
He'd
just appear in somebody's living room.
Yes.
Yeah, like, right.
Whoa.
Can you move? You're blocking the TV. I'm trying to
watch
the show.
You cannot fight the Klingons. I wasn't fighting the Klingons. What? Get out of here.
Trying to watch Battlestar Galactica.
I'm just trying to have a beer. I had a long day at work. Come on.
Right. And there's another novel that explains that the Klingons enveloped the Organian homeworld in a energy shield
to
keep them from preventing wars.
Prevent their powers from coming out. So it's interesting. My question would be, if their powers only work in their own solar system, yet the Organian Peace Treaty governed the relations between the Klingon Empire and the Federation mm-hmm. all the way up through the end of Star Trek VI when the Khitomer Accords were agreed to. The Khitomer Accords replaced the Organian Peace Treaty. If this only works within that solar system,
right?
Just, you know, both sides just thought it would work elsewhere and they like never tested it or And what about all those battles that they did have? You know, what about Krug mm-hmm. and Kirk fighting? You know, what about Klaw and his periscope? And
yeah, I mean, why did the Organians stop the Romulans from killing, you know, everyone on Worf's homeworld?
Like, yeah.
Why didn't the Organians step in so many times?
I think it's probably because the writers didn't think about that.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we're going a bit far to explain how, yes, this simply just isn't something that got brought up again. Which is fine,
right.
Like, really. It's fine. We don't have to make it work. But it is interesting to think about how the original series had just these sort of one-off episodes. And, I mean, the Organian Peace Treaty is mentioned in the future, right? I mean, it's not like it completely goes away.
It's mentioned, at some point.
But I think it's sort of, the idea becomes not that the Organians are physically keeping them from fighting, but that they did agree to not fight anymore in the future for whatever reason.
That's kind of what I always imagined, was that, you know, this was what started them talking, and the Organians kind of helped, you know, create the treaty.
Yeah. Picard brought in a negotiator.
And Troy sensed that he was hiding something, but
yes, the Organians are hiding something, but I can't tell what it is. It's almost like they're energy. No, that's not true. I don't know what it is, Captain.
They can't be energy beings, or I would be pregnant right now.
Oh my goodness.
But no, if you think about the Klingons as they evolved in terms of their honor, that would make sense because, you know, as we see on Deep Space Nine, especially, the Klingons, I think they really value the treaty that they have with the Federation and the Kittimer Accords mm-hmm. as a matter of honor. And when they finally, you know, they threaten to break it here and there, but I think it means something to them. I mean, they've made an agreement. And they want to stand by their honor, and it does mean something to the Klingons that we know from the later series. And then when they finally do break that treaty about halfway through, you know, when the Dominion War is going on, it's a very, very serious matter for them. So it's not something that they take lightly.
Right.
And then we do see them come back around later on. So that all would make sense to me in terms of how Klingons and their honor evolved. That they would just kind of honor what the Organians told them. And then you just have, like, you know, renegade people like Claw, who is not acting on orders of the High Command. So here and there. All right. Well, any final thoughts on this episode? Anything that we haven't covered yet that you want to touch on?
How often does Kor appear? It's not until DS9 that he reappears, right?
Yeah.
He never comes back in TOS.
That was great. Yeah.
But then he's on several episodes of DS9.
He's on quite a few. He's on like three of them, I think. Blood Oath, of course, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and mm-hmm. The Sword of Kaelas, and Once More into the Breach, which is actually towards the end of the Dominion War. So he's there like all the way to the end of DS9.
Right.
Which is
amazing.
I've got something. So when they first arrive, they go in these, you know, into the Knights of the Round Table room, and Elborn gives them their native clothing, and they're standing there. It's like, we don't have our phasers. It's like, where are they? And we won't give those to you. And the only other piece of furniture in that room is a cabinet sitting against the wall.
And right.
You would think Spock at least would have thought, you know, maybe we should look inside that cabinet.
It would have been logical.
I figured.
Well, surely they wouldn't be dumb enough to put them in the cabinet.
Well, they don't have a whole lot of experience hiding physical objects, I guess.
Oh, that's true. Good point. We keep the goat supplies.
The paint.
Don't mind
what's
cabinet.
In here? The paint, green paint, a phaser, a communicator.
Oh, man. I mean, you do mention the outfits they give them to make them fit in. I mean, I especially like Spock's periwinkle tights.
He was rather fashionable.
They had sort of, they had sort of Ugg boots on too.
Yeah, but did you notice they were just like, what do you call them? Like a Santa Claus costume,
right?
Boot, you know,
that's
where they're
true.
Like on over his boots.
Yes,
it was the weirdest costume.
Well, you know, there was some kind of council meeting where they decided. They picked out this different clothing, and they decided that, well, if any corporeal beings ever come to our planet, we're going to make them wear this stuff and walk around the village. We just got it.
This will be hilarious.
Yeah, it's going to be so funny. Oh, you mentioned Kor when he appeared. My understanding from things I've read is that Kor was supposed to be kind of the nemesis to Kirk in the original series, but they couldn't get John Kalikos when they needed him for other stories. And so that's why you have Koloth showing up and Kang showing up as well. So he would have been around more.
That's too bad. That would have been really cool. I wonder how that would have changed things.
Yeah, like an actual recurring villain. Because I don't think did they even have any recurring villains on the original series?
I don't think they do back then.
No.
A couple people, I mean, Kor showed up in the animated series to be played by Jimmy Doohan. And
I
then
think
someone
Harry Mudd,
showed up.
Or as you know him, Greg, Henry Mudd.
Henry Mudd.
I think he's the only person
showed
up
twice.
Repeatedly. He was in two
That's
episodes,
right.
but
That's
I don't right. really consider him a villain. He's more of a comic relief character.
Right. And I believe Kor was going to be in season 4. in Gene Roddenberry's Magic Bag of season 4. There was a core episode planned that never ended up happening.
I think so. That's the one where he makes friends with the Tribbles, and he gathers them up, and there's the renegade Glommers that have set up their own homeworld somewhere, and they're going to go destroy the Glommer homeworld.
I'm not making a joke. They wrote a script. They actually
the Tribble
had a script
peace
for Core.
Treaty.
Yeah.
Goodness. Yes, the Triple Peace Treaty. That would have been fun.
Would it have been fun?
It would have. It would have in there like...
Dun, da, da, dun, 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 dun.
Triples may reproduce no more than once a month. And you will follow this rule to the T.
Right.
Or else I'm going to round up 200 Tribbles and execute them every hour until this promiscuous behavior ceases.
I was going to say, I want to, you know, obviously they weren't going to show 200 extras being gunned down. But imagine the scene of 200 Tribbles being gunned down by, like, you know, Klingon machine gun.
All the fluff flying out of it. It'd just be cushion, like small cushions that they found, right? They roll them in some glue and then roll them through cat hair.
Oh,
easiest way to make 200 Tribble props. Oh, man.
Okay.
All right. Well, I guess, you know, for me, I would say about this episode, I just think it's a great example of the strength of the writing and the storytelling on the original series. People sometimes think of the original series, you know, and maybe think of something like Spock's Brain, for example, this kind of very, very cheesy 60s sci-fi story. But that's kind of an outlier within the original series. I think, you know, most of the scripts have these really great messages and address real social issues. And this one's a great example of it for me. Establishes the Klingons. David, you said earlier when we first started this discussion about how this really established who the Klingons were. Of course, we've talked about how they evolved, but I think it established them as a very strong race and a very strong villain for Star Trek. And it was interesting because I was just writing some text for the show page earlier today, and I almost wrote the same thing that you said beforehand, just because that's what struck me about this episode as well. And what it does for the Klingons. But yeah, I mean, the castle from the Holy Grail and all the funny stuff and the tights and all that stuff aside, this is a really good episode of the original series, a really good episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it introduces the Klingons in a way that establishes them as very powerful villains, even if it's very different from how they're portrayed later in the series. I definitely leave this episode really glad that we're not at war with the Klingons now, because they look like they would be extremely formidable enemies. You know, it's, you know, compare this to, say, the introduction of the Ferengi in Next Gen. You know, this is certainly,
episode Whips and Fur.
Whips and Fur, yes. So they did a much better job here of establishing Spock, them as a very strong
Spock character. Would have looked fabulous in that fur vest, though. I thought this episode is a great example of the original series. It's, you know, one of my favorites, and it made me think hard about, you know, who we are. It gave us a villain and made us very similar to them. And in the end, I remember, you know, Kirk was furious at the Organians for stepping in. And when they were on the ship, you know, the final little joke between the crew, you know, Kirk had said, you know, we beat the odds, or Spock said that we beat the odds, you know, and it's like, no, the Organians raided the game. And so he was still kind of ticked off.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The game,
he really was.
He, you know, it really stuck with me that we're not, as humans, we're not quite ready for what's out there.
But yeah, no, it is an interesting way to end the episode with that pointing out that Kirk is still sort of needled by it. I hadn't actually thought of that.
Yeah. All right, great. Well, David, thanks for joining us today as we talk about the original series. Our first time talking about TOS in a while, isn't it, Greg?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah. So before we go, David, tell everybody where they can find you on the interwebs first, and also a little bit more about your project that you've got coming up that you're working on here.
You can find me on Twitter at sci-fi_core. And also on Facebook, I've got a page that's Sci-Fi Commons, all one word. And what I'm working on now, I've got two things. Next week, or I'm not sure when this will air, but I'm going to only tweet, I'm going to only video tweet. So everything that I tweet or post on Facebook is going to be a video, video YouTube. And I'm working on a web show of my own, kind of a talk show-ish. I haven't quite worked out all the details, but I'm just kind of plowing forward. I figure it's going to suck at first, and I'll learn from it and, and have fun. So my goal is just to have fun, and I'd love to have as many people join me as can.
Oh, that sounds great. Really interesting. So we'll put links to that in the show notes. And now just let me clarify here. Now, when you say you're going to only video tweet next week, now you're not going to like tweet videos like of yourself, you know, brushing your teeth or
that's not,
you know,
my
making
plan,
dinner.
But, you know, if I'm tweeting from the toilet, I don't know. I might have to figure out some way around.
Right.
No, I'll probably set up a camera, but I think it'll be interesting to see what I learned from that. I think
yeah,
videos.
I'll look forward to that.
It'll be interesting. I don't think I've seen anyone do that before. Mm-hmm. Just video tweeting for a week. So definitely sounds interesting.
Well, it's great to have a fellow Seattleite here on the show, and it's also great to talk about TOS. Right now we're sort of on a regular schedule. It means it's always going to be over a month since we've talked about TOS.
Well, or any series at that point.
Or any series, basically.
We're going to cycle
always means
through the series in order.
Exactly. So every time we do it again, it's going to be like, oh my goodness, we haven't done Next Gen in 5 weeks.
It's been so long.
Right.
It's like someone used the mind scanner on me and I lost my memory.
Right. Indeed. So I was gonna mention something non-Star Trek related. That's coming out this week is the 3D re-release of Star Wars Episode 1. Now, is that coming to Japan, Chris? Have you seen any news about it?
I'm sure it's coming here. Now that you mention it, I actually do think that I saw some banner about it this morning on the web somewhere. But I don't know when it's being released. I don't know if it's the same time as there or if it's going to take a little longer. Because they've got to bring in the voice actors to redo all of the lines that George Lucas changed this time in Japanese.
Hayden Christensen has been inserted in even more scenes. He's in episode 1. I don't know why. Anakin's only 8 years old. But there's Hayden sitting on the corner looking awkward.
I don't remember seeing him in that big Jawa transport with all the droids they had stolen. What's he doing over there in the corner?
Oh, well, I'm sure it's for the best. But I was going to mention, I will be going to a midnight screening of episode 1. So if anyone's in the Seattle area and wanting to come along, feel free to message me on Twitter. I'm sure this is the one that is going to be hardest to get people to come along to. 3 years from now, the original film from 1977 will be released. And I think even though it's in 3D, people that don't like 3D are still going to want to go see it just to see Star Wars again on the big screen. And I'm excited for that. I'm excited for basically 3, 4, 5, and 6, but I'm still going to be there for 1 and 2. I'm just that big a fanboy. I'd even go see Star Trek 5 if it was released in 3D.
Well, I was going to say what I'm waiting on is for the theatrical 3D re-release of Star Trek the Motion Picture, because I want to experience that wormhole scene in 3D.
Right.
And I'm also just curious if the three-dimensional image does anything to improve those uniforms.
Right. Oh, goodness. I wouldn't want to. I'm not going to go there. But there are a lot of actually interesting scenes in the motion picture where they're like traveling forward through a tunnel. It'd be interesting to see that in 3D. I'd pay for the motion picture, actually. So anyway, 3D, it's the wave of the future. But anyway, if someone wants to join me with episode one, feel free to send me a message, as we're going to talk about now. We can be found on Twitter at TrekFM. Yep. Chris posts with a little dash C, and I post with a little dash G, so you can tell us apart. And then I post as Greg Harbin, mostly talking about Battlestar, but also a little bit of Star Trek here and there, and a little bit of complaining about living in suburban Seattle, which is hellish at times, to be nice.
You can't complain. Didn't Ronald D. Moore tell you? No whining.
No whining, exactly. So where can we find you on the Twitters, Chris?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at CBrianJones. That's Brian with a Y. And actually haven't been tweeting very much the past week or so. My schedule has been insane.
I thought it was just because Alabama won the championship and there's nothing else to talk about.
There's nothing. Yep. Mission accomplished. There's nothing else to talk about. They hung up the banner and everything down there at Bryant-Denny. But you can find me generally tweeting about Japan or design or art or football or Star Trek, all kinds of stuff going on. And you can, of course, also, if you want to send us a text message, like earlier today in the news segment, we did a little mailbag segment. If you'd like to send us a message like that, have us talk about it on the show, you can do that by just going to trek.fm/contact. And you can also leave us a voicemail if you like. You can call 646-652-TREK. And you'll also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and over on G+ at our own short link, hyperchannel/trekfmg+. And Greg, I'm hoping one of these days Google is going to realize that it would be nice if you could actually have a Google Plus URL that had your name in it.
Yes. One of these days, Google will move into the 21st century.
Yes. Well, Greg, I did also want to mention MatterStream real quick. The show I did last week with Dr. Seth Shostak talking about SETI and First Contact was very popular. We've gotten amazing traffic to that site. And I have another one coming up on Monday. I interviewed Craig Sheeler, who is the executive producer of a new web series for Star Trek called Star Trek Secret Voyage that looks very interesting. So,
yeah, that's something I'm very excited for.
Yeah, so everyone tune in. That'll be out on Monday. And by the time you hear this show, it will already be out. And you can find out a little bit more about this very interesting series that's coming out. And let's also throw out, Greg, that people can find us on Stitcher, both Ready Room and MatterStream. Just in case you're streaming this from the website and you don't use iTunes, you can get us there. And just drop by our site and check out all the stuff we got going on there. Trek trivia, games, feature articles, and all kinds of stuff. So, well, Greg, I'm going to head out. I've got to beam back up to the ship because I don't know why he did this, but Kirk left Sulu in charge. And, you know, I'm just afraid that Sulu's going to get a little bit too excited to be in command. And I better get back up there and make sure the ship's still in one piece.
All right, Chris. I do think it's time to stick an overheated disruptor in it because the Ready Room is done.